Hello, everybody. Welcome to Heart of the Matter. I'm your host, Elizabeth Vargas, and today I am really excited to talk to a man who is a good friend and is also chairman of the Partnership and Addictions Board of Directors, Jamie Niven. Now, Jamie grew up with plenty of advantages. He was the son of Academy Award-winning actor David Niven and led a wildly successful career in both business and philanthropy. But like so many people, he also faced his fair share of struggles. He lost his mom when he was quite young, and he grew up in the shadow of his celebrity father, who was known really worldwide. And all this was augmented by a compulsion for alcohol, which followed him into adulthood. And actually, it took him until the age of 65, after a series of embarrassing confrontations that brought, you know, his not so hidden demons to light, that Jamie found recovery and gave up alcohol. 10 years later, Jamie is making a difference for all the people who are impacted by addiction, not just because he speaks out about his own recovery, but most important for his amazing work for the Partnership to End Addiction, which is helping so many families. Today, I welcome Jamie Niven to Partnership to End Addiction's podcast, Heart of the Matter. Jamie Niven, great to see you today. You are the son of an extraordinarily famous man, David Niven, an Academy Award-winning actor. He made more than 100 movies. You definitely had a privileged upbringing, but it must have been challenging to be the son of a father so famous.
I guess the answer to that would be pretty much the same for all those Hollywood kids that I knew.
Yeah,
I don't think any of them had an easy go. I know, you know, it's funny you asked that because I don't think of it necessarily every day of my life that it was a difficult time because, you know, you get the cards and you play the cards.
Mm-hmm. And many would say you got a good hand of cards.
Most people would. And I don't go about saying that he was a difficult, complicated man because, you know, I wrestled with that. And I always thought, you know, when people come up and say, God, it must have been great to be David Niven's son, I don't say to them, oh, you have no idea how awful it was. I don't do that because it wasn't that bad. It just that it was lonely. I guess in hindsight, that's the thing that draws me to that conclusion. And I remember I have this great friend who I'm sure you know, Sherry Lansing, who was not only the head of Paramount, but also the head of Fox. And she's a very close friend of mine, big time. And I had a cup of coffee with her about a year ago before the pandemic started. And I said to her, why do you think it is that he never came to see me when I was at Harvard? And she said, after all these years, you haven't figured it out? And I said, what do you mean? She said, because he was a narcissist. And narcissists can't tolerate the success of the other around them.
Even when the other is their child?
Yeah. So he never showed up, I guess, because he was just pissed that I went there. That's the only explanation I can possibly give, because mostly you'd be happy if your kid goes to any college. Thank God you get in somewhere. This was Harvard, you know? And yet, nope, not at all. So Sherry helped me about a year ago getting my arms around it a little better than I had, I must be frank with you.
Not to take it so personally, perhaps.
Not to take it personally at all.
Right.
And it's too bad I didn't have that under wraps when I was about 18. It took us about 73. But, you know, he had a wonderful career. He started out in the British Army, and he was able to leverage that skill of his, which is to be charming and to be able to act. Into, as you pointed out, making over 100, actually it was 100 movies on the nose, and winning the Academy Award for Best Actor. And he was only on the screen for 18 minutes for that performance.
Which movie was it?
It's called Separate Tables. Some major players in that movie. Rita Hayworth and Burt Lancaster and my father and Deborah Carr. But he was only on for a very short period of time, and he won. I think he was the only actor to be hosting the Academy Awards that also won. So, you know, it was a charmed and lucky life in many respects. And he always admitted it was lucky. He, you know, really, whether he was kidding or not, I don't know, but he always thought it was lucky.
And you were lucky in many ways. You had a lot of privilege. You had access to amazing places. You spent time growing up in the south of France and in Switzerland. And I mean, you went to great schools, you met famous people. And yet you've said of your childhood that the overwhelming memory of it was one of loneliness.
And I think it's very simple to explain why. My mother died when I was 6 months old. And I think that's in a nutshell, right there. And I remember John Cheever wrote once that the inescapable fact is that his mother died when he was young, and that lingered with him his entire life. I think that when I see my daughter with her son, for example, you know, and the hugging and the holding and all that good stuff, you know, you don't get that. And therefore, you do come out. At the end of the day, you have to say yourself, you're pretty lonely. Yeah, there was some tremendous privileges, don't get me wrong. Of course, there were marvelous moments and all that. Mm. And plenty of them, by the way. But it was that under-gut thing about always feeling lonely and not with it and not inclusive and all kinds of stuff that came out. And that...
It's funny, my ex-husband lost his mother when he was 2. He has no memory of her, but that loss is a huge influence on his life to this day. Most of the songs he wrote were about losing his mother. It's funny how something like that you can't remember your mom, you can't remember losing your mom.
No, of course not.
That absence is powerful.
I think the fact that that incredible void, as you rightly point out, it's one you may not understand. You may not get it for a long time that this happened to you and this is why you are this way or this is why you're sad or whatever it is. But for him and for me, it was the same, because whether you're 2 or you're 6 months, it makes no difference. You don't have any memory at all. And that's I'm sure that had a lot to do with the progression of that loneliness and how you sort of staunched it by drinking.
How old were you when you started drinking?
Oh, I'm one of those average people who in an AA meeting said I started drinking when I was 15. You know, everyone says that I was 15, I was 14, but I was 15. Mm-hmm. I do remember when, I remember why, I remember all that good stuff. And it went with me for 50 years.
50.
Yes, 50.
5 decades.
Yes.
Was it always out of control or excessive, or were you moderate as a drinker for a while?
I'm not sure I could ever say I was moderate. I think that I was able to hold jobs and not be fired because I was a drunk. Let's put it that way. But I would say to you, I remember I was having lunch with a friend of mine, an Italian, and I said to him, "You think that a bottle of wine is too much?" And he said, "In a day?" I said, "No, before lunch." and he said, "Are you crazy?" And I didn't want to tell him the real truth, is that it would be a couple of bottles at lunch and certainly get the evening started with another one. Yes, excessive would be I'm sure anyone you talk to would, if I really, because no one ever is really honest about how much they drank. They always, "Oh, I drank a little bit, you know," or, "Oh, I just had 2 drinks. Bullshit. It would be rather vast.
Mm. Yeah. You sort of tossed that off as saying you were never fired from, you know, any of the jobs you had. You had a lot of big jobs, Jamie. I mean, you were... Yeah. Quite successful in your career at Lehman Brothers and later at Sotheby's. You had a huge career. How did you manage to have that huge career and be drinking as much as you were drinking?
Well, I think it would have been a whole lot better if I hadn't drunk. And I was chairman of an oil and gas company, which was a big success for me when in the late 80s and early 90s. And I drank pretty heavily then. We had Russian partners, and so they obviously drank heavily. I guess, you know, in the end of the day, I look back at all these years and say, what did you do? What could you have done better? I think almost everything would be the answer. Yeah.
Did anybody in your life ever say you drink too much?
Yes.
And what did you say when they said that?
Wife number one.
Wife number one.
And we were married for 30 years. And she did. And she knew what she was talking about. Her mother was an alcoholic and her mother committed suicide. I just wish that I could have listened to her better. I wish that I could have somehow gotten help at that time. If I could have stopped drinking then, life would have been very, very different. But no, I didn't need help. Are you kidding me? I could stop this anytime. Sure you can.
You said once, when you go out at night, you think you're a 10, the life of the party. You think you're a 15 at the end of the night, but actually you're a 1.
That's what a friend of mine said to me when I called him up and asked him to come over and chat with me. He was a very interesting guy, very successful, who had stopped drinking when he was about 26. And he came over to the house. He lived very near me. And he said to me, number one, I know we're not talking about golf today. I played a lot of golf with him. And he sat down and he said that. That's the first thing he said. He did say something else. He said, if you get to a 0, it's going to be harder to help you than if you're a 1.
Wow. Was he there to try and help you get sober?
For 90 days, he called me or texted me every day. He gave me the advice of go stop drinking and go to AA meetings. Okay. And then he added two things. He added that remark about, you know, you go out at night, you think at the end of the night, you're a 15.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the other thing was when you get up in the morning, there's going to be a guy standing behind you. He's better looking than you. He's smarter than you. He's funnier than you. And he's dresses a whole lot better than you. And he's going to tell you he wants you to have a drink today. And you're going to say to him, no, Mr. Alcohol, I'm not having a drink today. I'm not going to talk about tomorrow. I'm not going to talk about yesterday. But I'm not having a drink today. And you have to do that every day that Mr. Alcohol comes and stands behind you. It's about today, Jamie. It's not about tomorrow.
This friend of yours was in recovery himself?
He had quit drinking when he was 26. He had a really bad problem. He had a great friend of his who told him, there's nothing, Jimmy, that you won't be able to do in life if you stop drinking. But if you drink the way you drink now, you'll never amount to anything.
Why do you think you were able to quit? You quit drinking when you were
65.
65.
Yeah.
Why were you able to quit at the age of 65 when you couldn't quit or didn't quit for whatever reason when your first wife told you have a problem?
Well, I think honestly, it was an issue of me being rude to a client's wife at an event that we had underwritten in Aspen, Colorado. And I was rude to a woman and her daughter. And it was ugly and it was not nice. And the husband came up to me and told me I've been rude to his wife and I should apologize. And I said no. And I left the nightclub kind of thing and went home. And I realized the next day that was not great. That really wasn't. And I turned out, I went downstairs to the hotel and I ran into this couple and she hugged me. And he shook my hand and said, you know, Jamie, some of us have bad days. You had a bad day yesterday. I really, you know, I must tell you, that was very touching. I went back to New York. I went to see our CEO and I told him the story. He said, I already know it. You've had 4 of your colleagues have called and complained about you and how you behaved.
Wow.
I was chairman, by the way, of Sotheby's, the Americas then. And he said, you have to think about what you want to do about it. And you have to come up with some plan. take the weekend. Let me know on Monday. Well, over the weekend, I saw my friend Jimmy, and in that weekend, I called up Silver Hill, the place in Connecticut. I didn't want to go to rehab. I wanted to do outpatient rehab. That didn't exist. They said they had a couple of psychiatrists that worked uniquely on addiction problems. They gave me the numbers. I called the first woman. She wasn't there. Second lady answered the phone, and I started going to her. So by the time I got in on Monday, I had signed up with this lady, and I'd gone to my first AA meeting. So I had done something concrete about this issue, and the story kind of ends there for your colleagues being upset with you, because there's really nothing more they can say. They've already said what they had to say. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to do something about it and you're serious about it, it's kind of the end of the story. And that's exactly what it was. It was the end of the story. I ran into this couple a number of times. And every time I saw them, I said 5 years, you know, or 4 years, or whatever.
Really? You told them, this couple, that you stopped drinking as a result of what happened?
Totally. I told them that.
Wow.
Yeah, she said to me, I'm so glad that I've played a role in helping you. Yeah, that's it. I haven't had a drink in 10 years.
Was it easy for you to stop, Jamie? I mean, you're sort of like the unicorn in the recovery rooms, the person who quit the first time he or she tried.
I guess I'd tell you, in the beginning, I was convinced that my strength of character would deal with this, and I didn't have to worry. I'd just get through this, baby. Just a couple of weeks with you, the psychiatrist, and I'm all done. But I, you know, step one, I got it. I read that step, and I read it about 20 times, and I finally realized
you're powerless over alcohol.
It was bigger than me. Yeah. Mm. We've all had to realize, that's, if you don't do that one, it doesn't matter what steps you do. I mean, that's the one, right? I listened to that. I listened to her, and I went to meetings. And I sort of got away from friends of mine that I used to hang around who drank a lot. And I kind of picked a different kind of life, if you will. But nonetheless, you know, I was still doing charity auctions, and I was, you know, I was doing regular auctions for that matter. So I was amazed that I could do it without having a drink, actually.
That's part of getting sober that I know a lot of people in recovery struggle with in real time, and people outside of recovery might not understand that part of you putting on, you know, getting dressed and getting ready to face your life every day without the crutch of several glasses of wine or liquid courage or something to take the edge off. I mean, in many ways, you would have to relearn how to go about your life completely stone cold sober.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to. I mean, in my particular case, I was, apart from being chairman of Sotheby's, I did a lot of auctions. You're not just an auctioneer. You have a job, and then you're an auctioneer. And I used to have a glass of vino, not before I did a Sotheby's sale, but a charity auction at night, I would always have a glass of vino.
Which, by the way, I know most people, you know, listening probably have never conducted an auction. I haven't either, but I know it's really hard.
Someone said to me, is it really frightening? I said, do a Robin Hood auction in front of 4,500 people and you're alone on the stage up there. That's frightening.
So once you stopped drinking, did you tell everybody in your life that you would stop? Yes.
Yes.
You were very open about it.
Totally.
How did people react?
Boringly so, I have a suspicion. Well, you know, I didn't rush into a room and say, hey, everyone, I'm not drinking anymore. In the beginning, I wouldn't go to dinner. If I was invited for dinner, I wouldn't go there until sort of 5 minutes before dinner was served.
Mm-hmm. Missing the cocktail hour.
Right. I didn't linger around after dinner. I always told the hostess that I wasn't drinking in case they were making some sauce with wine or whatever. I uh, I didn't mind it when people say, oh, come on, you got to have a drink. This is great wine. I didn't mind saying, no, I've done it. I had this older friend of mine who was from Texas, very successful man. He'd been the chairman of the War on Cancer, and he'd been chairman of the board of Memorial Sloan Kettering, where I've been on the board for a long time. And I got to know this man. He was a very successful, wonderful man. I said to him one day, why don't you drink? And he said, I did all I needed to do by the time I was 45. And I answered today, people say, why don't you drink? I did all I needed to do by the time I was 65. And that's seriously, that's how I kind of, I handle it that way. You know, and some, I knew a lot about wine, and I had a pretty good wine collection, and I was one of these people early on in the day that really loved California wine and Oregon Pinot Noirs and things like that. I could talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And not long ago, someone said to me, what do you think this wine is any good? I said, what's the year? The guy said, 2012. I said, I can't help you. I said, it was 2009. I could help you, but I can't help you after 2010.
Because you haven't tasted it.
He kind of looked at me like, what the fuck? And I said, no, no, you got to understand something. I know nothing about 2010 on. Zero. So, you know, yeah, I don't, I'm not, you know something, Elizabeth, I'm not embarrassed by the fact that I got the bug. I'm not embarrassed that I had this disease, which is the fatal disease that's curable. No, I'm not. I'm not at all. And if I help anybody get down this road, if I have one person, then I've done something good. So I think by talking about it and being open, I think it's really important.
I ask because we know that the shame and stigma around addiction prevents. So I know I felt so, in addition to grappling with, you know, my own addiction to a good Chardonnay, you know, I just felt so much shame about it, that we know that the stigma around this disease keeps so many people. I mean, some statistics, according to one organization, 41% of people who need treatment don't get it because of the stigma. I think it's actually a heck of a lot higher.
I bet it's higher. But, you know, the stigma thing is what we talk about at the Partnership to End Addiction. The stigma for drug addiction is greater than the stigma for alcohol addiction. And if you have a son who's a boozer, his friends are like, well, he drinks too much, that boy. But if you got a son who's hooked on heroin, he's a drug addict. It's a total different set of stigmas, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we have to help fight in this whole battle that we're doing for families with the opioid crisis. But
once you got sober, how did your life change?
Well, I think that number one, I had entered into a relationship with someone that I doubt would have happened if I'd been a boozer. And that's been terrific. Number two, I know from both of my girls that my relationship with them is totally different.
Really? How so? Yeah.
I think in the sense that I'm much closer to them now. We talk more together. I'm not in the bag ever. So our relationship and our closeness and all that is, for me anyway, it's 100% better.
I used to describe drinking as giving me what a faux intimacy. I thought I was connecting with people and,
of course,
you know, sharing and really, really, and you wake up the next morning, you can't even remember the conversation in its entirety. Right. Real authenticity and real intimacy,
right,
doesn't happen when you've had half a bottle or a bottle of wine under your belt.
Yeah, you're right. It's that faux intimacy. You're right. That's exactly what it is. It's that, this is great. I am so good at this. You know, this is fantastic. And you're not. You're a bloody failure. And you've got to somehow pull yourself together one way or the other, if you can. And a lot of people can't.
You mentioned something early on in our conversation where you wondered what your life would have been like if you had stopped drinking decades earlier.
Yeah.
I know I do that. And I know it's not a healthy thing to, you know, to do that. Because we can't change the past. We can only, you know, live in the present and prepare and for the future. But it's a hard thing not to do. It's a hard thing not to go, oh, if only I had put that wine glass down 10, 15 years before I did.
I think I would have gotten a lot fewer arguments. I would have been a much kinder, better person, for sure. I would have been more successful in my business life, I'm sure. And I think that I would have had a much better life, for sure.
And can you come to some sort of peace with the fact that you still were able to do all that you did do and that you did put it down and you have had 10 years?
Yeah, I honestly, I have a hard time looking at myself in the mirror and saying, you know, you've done well.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think like that, I guess. I know that I've done things that are, you know, I've done things that I'm sure I should be very proud of. You know, I've been on the board of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for 42 years.
Wow.
I know I've helped tons of people. But I don't look at myself and pat myself on the back and say, hey, that was really well done. I really don't. I think I'm very lucky to be in a position where I can pick up the phone and I can get someone on the phone to deal with my friend who's got cancer or the parent or the child, whatever it is. That's earned, obviously. But I don't, Elizabeth, walk around patting myself on the back. I just don't.
No, that wasn't my question. My question was more, are you able to walk around without going, I mean, I know this is something I do, so maybe I'm projecting that if only, the if onlys, if only I had stopped drinking earlier, if only I had, you know, done that inner work that getting sober forced me to do, and if only I had been sober longer, my life would have been better or this way or more that.
Oh, I think we all know that our lives would have been better. I don't think there's any doubt. That's pretty straightforward as far as I can see it anyway. I'm convinced that, look, I wouldn't have gotten divorced, I don't think. We'd still be a family. And that's a long time ago. We got married in 1968. So I just think that it's a tragedy in a sense that people can't get their arms around it and can't stop. It's so sad to see it. And you know it. You've been through it. You know what it's like. And it's just, it saddens me to think that I went through all that. You know. On the other hand, God damn it, you can't think about the past. You got to think about today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be going to a meeting today at 6 o'clock on Zoom. I hate it. Something wrong with an AA meeting on Zoom. It's kind of weird. You know, I'm glad I'm there. I'm glad I'm able to do it. I'm glad I've been able to get help, and I'm glad that it stuck for the time being, obviously.
Well, thank you, Jamie. I think you're going to help a lot of people just by telling your story. You know, anything we can do to encourage people, it's a good thing. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you, Elizabeth, as always.
Thanks so much for listening to my talk with Jamie Niven. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on our website at drugfree.org/podcast. As a reminder, if you need help with a loved one who's struggling with substance use, you can text 55753 or visit drugfree.org. Talk to you soon.